Thank you, and thank you for coming out tonight. I know that with this, most of these events have been held in some really cold, snowy evenings, and now we have a very nice, warm, and sunny one. So I appreciate you coming inside tonight, and welcome to the third Ann Arbor Sustainability Forum. I'm serving as the moderator tonight here, so I'm going to sort of set the stage, give you a little bit of foundation, but we have some really high-quality, talented speakers. Each of them will be speaking for about 10 minutes, and then we'll have time at the end, a good 35 minutes, for questions and answers. But we do want to get through all of them before we move into that. First, I'll give you a little bit of context in terms of the sustainability series. A lot of the topics in the series come out of work that has been laid the last couple years through the development of the city's Climate Action Plan. After the Climate Action Plan was developed, there was a climate partnership that came together to try to work on implementing the Climate Action Plan. As many of you know, there's a lot of effort, a lot of community time, government time put into plans, and we want to make sure that there's just as much time or more on implementing these plans. So the partnership was launched in 2013. There have been quite a bit of partners on that, especially the City of Ann Arbor staff has been helping, the Ecology Center, the Ann Arbor Area Community Foundation has helped, my organization, the Huron River Watershed Council, have all been integral in terms of moving this ahead. I want to also stress that if any of you are interested in becoming more engaged and active with the Climate Partnership, I really encourage it. You can visit the city's website and contact Jamie Kidwell, but we really do need help on so many different fronts in terms of implementing it. But tonight, we are talking about sustainable systems. And when I was first asked to talk about this, I thought, wow, the city runs so many different kinds of systems. Which system are we talking about? And especially, I think you get the sense by who the speakers are and my background, we're really looking at the wet weather projects, the stormwater systems throughout the city. And we'll be talking a lot about community-led solutions to them in light of some of the projections that we have for climate and specifically around increased precipitation, increased droughts, and how we can manage our systems to be more sustainable. You'll be hearing from Jen Lawson from the City of Ann Arbor, Susan Bryan with Washtenaw County Water Resources Commission, Shannon Gibb Randall from Insight Design, and Nathan Ayers from the Permaculture Partnership at the University of Michigan. So briefly, in terms of systems that the city manages, I was trying to find a great slide that I had seen in a presentation about a year ago that was a cross-section of a city intersection. And in that cross-section, it went underground and it showed all the different kinds of pipe systems in terms of drinking water and wastewater and stormwater, but also in terms of the cables that go for connectivity, the gas lines, the roads, the street lights, all the things that the city is in charge of. And it really gives you a sense of all of the different kinds of systems. Where we tend to look is the drinking water system, the wastewater system, and the stormwater system. Tonight, as I mentioned, we're really talking about the stormwater system. I know many of you in the room know some of this basic information that I'm giving here, but I just want to refresh in terms of stormwater systems. There's a couple of different pictures that I provided here in trying to get a little bit of a sense of what stormwater is, why it matters in an urban area. On the left, you're looking at sort of the residential area. On the right-hand side, you have two different examples. I'm sorry if you can't see this very well, but it talks about separated stormwater systems, and then there are also stormwater systems that are combined. Ann Arbor has a separated system where they have a separate wastewater treatment plant and sewer goes there, and the stormwater goes directly to the river. And it's one of the things that all of the speakers will be talking about tonight is the systems are very different, and we want to talk about how the city is managing the stormwater system and some of the community-led partnerships to help address that. This is one last slide that just tries to hit home a little bit about why in an urban area like the city of Ann Arbor, stormwater becomes more of an issue. And it also illustrates some of the potential solutions that we'll be talking about tonight. If you see on the left-hand side, this takes us back to sort of fifth grade when we learned the water cycle. But we learned that when it rains with precipitation, the trees and the greenery take up about 40% through evapotranspiration. You usually get about 50% that's infiltrated through the soils and the roots of the trees that refills the groundwater and is the base flow to our rivers. And you usually only have about 10% of runoff off of the landscape. When you start developing that with buildings and houses and parking lots and roads and rooftops, you change the water cycle tremendously. You increase our stormwater runoff. You see that we have decreased evapotranspiration. We have decreased infiltration into the groundwater and the base flows to our rivers, and you have increased runoff. And runoff is warmer. We're worried about sort of the quality of it, warmer, carrying more pollution. It's also, in terms of quantity, it comes in greater forces or sort of plugs of water into our river. So I think the question that the speakers will be talking about is, how do we manage and build a sustainable stormwater system? Tonight you'll hear a lot about conveyance of water, and conveyance is how we've traditionally talked about stormwater systems, getting water off of our roads, of our rooftops very fast. But you'll also hear some new innovative ideas about recycling water, controlling water, treating water, thinking of stormwater in more of a closed loop system. So that we think about water instead of getting it off the landscape and into the river, is thinking about how we might creatively capture water in our neighborhoods by means of diversion or filtration or retention and reuse. You'll also hear about many of the city's studies that have been done in the last couple of years that really help them understand their stormwater systems more effectively and where some of the key problems are and what can be done. Why? Why do we care about stormwater? Why do we care about trying to mitigate some of this? A lot of this is the water quality of the Huron River, and especially because we get 80 to 85% of our drinking water from the Huron, it's very important to us. It's important to us for flooding reasons. We've seen a lot more flooding of our streets and our basements in the past couple years. So these are some of the reasons that the city is addressing this and the partners are. Why do we think it's going to get worse, and what are some of the trends that we've seen? We've been working the last 4 or 5 years with what's called GLESA, the Great Lakes Integrated Science Assessment at the University of Michigan and MSU, to do some more downscaled studies about what we can expect to see in terms of precipitation, high heat days, drought, et cetera. And these are some of the more startling numbers in terms of what we can expect and what we're experiencing. The 25% of the increase in precipitation, and I know that to a lot of people they'll say, well, what does that really mean, 25%? So we've tried to put it in a term that people can understand. So how many Michigan stadiums could you fill with the precipitation that falls on Ann Arbor in a single year? 117. To give you a perspective of what 25% is going to look like, that's 23 more Michigan stadiums than 30 years ago. So that's just trying to get a sense, because people look at that and they think, oh my God, what does that mean? Just in terms of the volume of water. It is, I'll grant, it's a little silly to be talking about that, but it does try to give you a little perspective. So what is sustainable? How should we be managing stormwater? And I think a lot of it has to do with some of the, wasn't comprehensive up here, but some of the different ideas about recycling water, controlling water, treating it, and reusing it. And at this point, I have a couple of examples here, but I really am going to turn it over to our speakers who are going to go more in depth about some of these different options and some of the solutions that we're using in terms of the traditional, the more gray infrastructure of pipes and detention basins, also with the more green or natural solutions. So at this point, I'll invite Jen Lawson up first. She's the Water Quality Manager with the City of Ann Arbor.
Well, thank you all. It's always wonderful going, speaking right after Laura. I think she painted a really great picture for all of you about that overview of why we're here. It really comes down to protecting our resources. There's a lot of reasons why we need to protect those natural resources. I'd like to talk a little bit about the holistic overview from the city standpoint. The city is responsible for maintaining a lot of things that you might not see or you might just take for granted. I'd like to give you a little bit of the philosophy of how we manage those systems, what we're mandated to manage, and what we can't afford to manage in some instances. I'm going to give a little bit of logistics and statistics. I don't have all of the numbers memorized. I should, but I don't. So for reference, the city of Ann Arbor, we're all very familiar with the city of Ann Arbor. Okay, bounded by the freeways. And this is kind of, you know, the map that everyone is used to seeing. This is the map that I think of. This is the map that I think some of you might think of in the room as well. And it really comes down to, it's not just a border-to-border issue. It's not just that jurisdictional issue, because the water from the Huron River flows through our city, and our stormwater impacts people downstream, people in Lake Erie, and we need to think about that a little more holistically. It's not just our actions in our own neighborhoods. One map, though, that I'm not going to show you is our stormwater network. It would be a big blob. It would be all black. We have a lot of pipe, and we have a lot of conveyance systems at the city. But what I will show you is some statistics. We have 231 miles of stormwater pipe in the city of Ann Arbor. That's underground. That's the stuff that you can't see. Now, 231 miles gets you from Ann Arbor to just about 10 miles short of Chicago. So if you're going to take a road trip or if you're going to float in a kayak down the stormwater pipes, you can almost get to Chicago. The city has a lot of statistics about these pipes that are in the ground, when they were put in, how big they are, what they're made of. This is part of our asset management. We have to make sure that we are appropriately maintaining and managing our system. What's interesting to note is that we have pipe in the ground for our stormwater system that was installed in the 1900s. That's the decade, 1900s. That means that we have pipes that are over 100 years old. That doesn't mean that they're bad. Pipes have a really long life. It's concrete. It's not under a lot of stress. And so this 410 feet, I know it's not a lot, but, you know, that's kind of that infrastructure story that we can start telling. And I'm going to step out of my stormwater hat for a minute. We have these numbers for our drinking water and for our sanitary sewer system, and they're not dissimilar. They're the same. We have a very old infrastructure. Ann Arbor was settled a long time ago, and the infrastructure that we have is old. Doesn't mean it's bad. It just means that it's old. One of my favorite statistics, though, if you kind of look at how old those pipes are, over 20% of the pipes were installed before the Korean War. How many of you were around for the Korean War? I hear some great war stories from my grandfather, but when you start thinking about things in those time statistics, the number that's not included up here is the pipes that you're the conveyance that you can see. So of the 231 miles, you need to add about 300 more miles of above-ground conveyance. So we have 541 miles of conveyance. That's our entire system. That gets you from Ann Arbor to about St. Louis. That's 541 miles that the city has to maintain and manage. And there's only a handful of us. Some of the things that our city stormwater program achieves or accomplishes, maintaining what we have, improving what we have, and managing what we have. That's the simple way. I'll give you the technology terms, though. Asset management is maintaining what we have. That's all of your operational information, maintenance scheduling, how we maintain our system with work orders, how we have, excuse me, how we maintain that inventory of our stormwater system. We actually have roughly 19 full-time employees, including the field guys, including myself, including techs that are in the labs that work on our stormwater system. And so that's 19 people, again, to manage 541 miles of conveyance. We also improve what we have, and that's the capital improvements. So when you see construction projects, we call those capital projects because we are improving the capital of the city, those capital assets. And then the management one is kind of that really boring and paper-heavy one. It's the administrative regulatory requirements. It's the permits from the state. It's the federal permits. We have a lot of mandates that kind of hold our hands to the fire on what we can do with stormwater. For example, we can't flush our toilet and put it into the river. It's kind of a bad thing. That's a really good generalization, but we are mandated for so many controls for stormwater. In fact, we have mandates to improve stormwater at the end, or if you want to say as it enters down into Ford Lake, we have to address E. coli, we have to address phosphorus, we have to address sediments. So there's a lot of mandates that we do have to balance. And to balance that program, we have level of service principles. Now, these principles actually were set in 2007 as part of a public engagement process. Some of you may have been part of that process, and again, I thank you for that. But it really comes down to a lot of those key ideas that we know the public expects from city staff and that we adhere to as those guiding principles. Some of them are pretty obvious. Protect public health, safety, welfare, protect ecological health. And so we have to protect the people, but also the birds and the bunnies and the fish. Making sure that we're doing comprehensive planning, so making the right decisions about how we manage that stormwater system. Encouraging shared responsibility, so it's not only the city. The city only owns, you know, a handful of land or a portion of the land in the city. There's a lot of private property. There's a lot of homes. There's a lot of residential properties. And their runoff does contribute to the city system. We make sure that we offer incentives to guide desired behaviors. Those of you who are Ann Arbor residents and have a rain barrel, I hope you're getting your credit on your stormwater bill. Those little kind of incentives for desired behavior, we make sure that we work with the public to encourage those behaviors. We educate our stormwater users. That's why I'm here tonight. But we have a lot of good outreach programs. We coordinate with the schools. We partner with the Ann Arbor Public School System for a second through sixth grade urban stormwater hydrology curriculum. And we've made sure to include the kids and the students and get them to touch the stormwater, get them to make that connection between the driveway on their property and the river that they enjoy fishing in. And the last bullet on here is kind of that money one, though, an understandable rate structure. So in the city of Ann Arbor, property owners pay a fee based on the amount of runoff from their property, and we want to make sure that that's an equitable number. And there's a whole lecture on that I could give. But making sure that what a resident is paying for out of their stormwater fee is appropriate. So I talked a little bit about aging infrastructure. We really are the caretakers of Mother Nature's stormwater system. This is a map of the city of Ann Arbor in downtown about the 1920s. You can see Allen Creek as it was still open prior to 1920. All of this creek is now underground in a pipe. But you can still see remnants of it. West Park, for example, is one of those areas where you can kind of tell there was something here that was pretty cool. But that creek still exists. It still has a floodplain. It still has bed and banks. It's in a pipe, and we're trying to control it. So some of the things that we do, I mentioned capital improvements. This is along Madison Ave. Madison was rebuilt last year. We attempt to mimic Mother Nature. Laura alluded to infiltration opportunities. We look for stormwater management techniques that mimic Mother Nature's original intentions. How can we get the stormwater to infiltrate back into the ground? And so this will actually take all of the runoff from the road, and we're able to infiltrate it into sandy soils underneath the project. Another way we can mimic Mother Nature is large-scale projects. This is a wetland complex Mary Beth Doyle Park. Some of you may have visited that. This stores stormwater in a flood event and allows it to infiltrate and allows it to flow naturally, so we can recreate some of those intentions that Mother Nature had. Smaller opportunities that we do have around the city. This is out at Burr Park. It doesn't look like much. It's not really exciting. But this small little infiltration channel is picking up all of the runoff from this parking lot and infiltrating it in. So that doesn't have to be an entirely porous road surface. It could be just one portion to make sure that all of our stormwater has that opportunity for infiltration. The thing to keep in mind is that maintenance doesn't go away. Just because we've built these systems to manage the stormwater, we still have to take care of it, just like we have to take care of our pipes. We still have to make sure that this vegetation is managed. We have to make sure that the sediment is removed from the system. And litter, that's the one thing I will say, is that Mother Nature never intended for garbage bags and cigarette butts. That's a big problem we do have with maintenance of our stormwater system. So I will close with this fantastic photo. This has to have been taken prior to 1920. This is actually Washington that these gentlemen are standing on, and this is Allen Creek that flows underneath it. This house is still here. I don't encourage you to trespass on private property, but keep in mind that this is below our feet in the Old West Side, and so we know that the Allen Creek still functions and is still there. So with that, I'm going to pass it along to Susan Bryan. Are you transitioning or am I? Very well. Susan is the Rain Garden Coordinator for the Washtenaw County Water Resource Commissioner's Office.
There you go. Thank you. Thank you. Actually, I could touch on a lot of pieces that Jen talked about. One is that our program is a partnership, so it's a partnership between the City of Ann Arbor and the Water Resources Commissioner's Office. Let's see, all sorts of other connections. So rain gardens are something that, those were all sorts of the assets that the city manages and that the big projects that the city do. Really, as citizens, we have the city do it for us. So that as a community, they're doing it for us. What I'm going to talk about more is what we can do as property owners and in our own yards and in our own lives. And a lot of people who take my Master Rain Gardener class, not a lot, but a few, there's always a few that live in apartments. So they always go out to other spots like parks and schools and put in rain gardens in those spots. So those are always good as well. So let me get a sense of who's in the room. Who here? So there's maybe a continuum of some people I see out there I know have built a rain garden. And then there's maybe people saying, why is it a rain garden? Don't all gardens get rain from the sky? So if you're over here and you've built a rain garden, can you raise your hand so I get a sense of, you've built with your own, you've had the shovel, you know, like out here. Okay. So and then what about people who, you know what a rain garden is and you're thinking about like where on my property maybe I could put one? There's a few people. Oh, so quite a few. Okay, good. And then what about like rain what? Like, is there, anyway, it's okay, because then it means I'm just not talking to the same people over and over again. Okay, good. All right, so I'll try to, I was going to like focus on one side or the other, but I will just talk about it, everything. So rain gardens are a way that instead of having the water run down the driveway, run into the gutter, into that inlet that Jennifer just showed in the street, and have it go wash all that pollution to the river, instead it soaks into your yard and feeds your plants water. So instead of treating water as a waste product, it's treating it as a valuable asset. So instead of going into that pipe on the left, it's feeding the rain garden on the right and looking fantastic. I have a bunch of photos of a rain garden looking great surrounded by parched grass. And the reason why rain gardens function is because of the plants. They're really the workhorses behind the rain garden. They are infiltrating that water into the ground. They're evapotranspiring it into the air. And without the plants and then also a lot of the organic material in the soil, it wouldn't work. Sands, of course, will infiltrate soil, but plants make the infiltration work so much better. And also, you get all sorts of other benefits from a rain garden, like attracting pollinators, butterflies, and birds, goldfinches, not just pigeons. We're not talking pigeons here. We're talking goldfinches. And all you need is a downspout. You can see this beautiful native garden. Actually, those are all local genotype natives, so we're into the, like, seriously cool plants. Those are taking the water from half of that person's roof and infiltrating it into the ground and looking great at the same time. This is a really good photo because you can see the water comes down the downspout and it's heading towards that driveway where it might just wash all the pollution from the driveway down into the gutter, but no, it gets caught in the rain garden. So that's what you're trying to do, is just slow that water down, infiltrate it into the soil. I'm intimately familiar with ice on the sidewalk, as I'm sure we all are, spending time chipping that ice away, as we did all winter. But something that, this is in my neighborhood where I walk by every day, and as you can see, the water comes down the downspout, and then it outlets right in front of the sidewalk. And so all winter, I'm sure that person's like chipping the ice away, and then that the next morning there'll be a little melt, and then it'll just cover it with water again, and it'll freeze again. And the next day they're chipping again, you know, chip it all out. And this is a solution that could, you could solve this problem with a rain garden. Because, yeah, that's not nice. This is a house where, actually, we partnered with the homeowner called us because of this reason. The downspout comes down, and then it comes and is underground in a little pipe, and then it pops up, but it's just in the lawn, and the lawn doesn't do a great job of infiltrating into the ground because the roots aren't very deep. So it just ran over the clay soil under, it just ran over the grass and onto the sidewalk and created ice. They were just tired of chipping ice, so they asked for our help in designing a rain garden. And that's the, actually, I designed sort of two bookend rain gardens so that there's one on each side. And there it is, just barely planted, but it totally solved the ice problem. If we want to be more specific, on clay, it's going to solve the problem 85% of the time. So every 15% of the time, it'll still overflow. But 85% of those times that it'll just fill up and just infiltrate into the ground. So instead of chipping that ice 10 times, you'll chip it 1.5 times, which is, that's kind of a, I mean, you're out there like talking to your neighbors 1.5 times. 10 times, that's work. Also, and Jan also mentioned that you can get a credit on the stormwater bill. So on your water bill, there's a line that says stormwater, and it's not a huge charge. And the credit is not huge, but you have it in perpetuity. And this is all the stuff that goes into that water. So sad. And actually, the raccoons are more of a problem. Laura knows more about this than I do, but the raccoons are more of a problem than the dogs. Probably because people are so good about picking up. Well, we see exactly how good we are this time of year as the snow melts. So, but you know, that's the kind of gross stuff that gets in the river, and we don't want it there. Because it causes fish kills and algae and all these issues that we've become more familiar with lately. So the county, in partnership with the city and then also in partnership with the community, has two basic programs. One is if you have a spot where you'd like to build a rain garden, I'll come to your house and we'll talk about it and I'll give you resources. And if you're going to build a great rain garden in the front of your yard and you want to have a sign and show off to your neighbors, then I'll even design it for you. So just like those folks we saw a little while ago, so that you have a beautiful rain garden, and we really want people to have a gorgeous one so that all their neighbors want to do the same thing. And then also, so those two at the bottom were designed by our office, one actually by Shannon Gibrendel, who's going to speak in a little bit, and then one by me. And then the top right is a master rain gardener designed rain garden. So she took the master rain gardener class, designed it herself, and those are folks that not only build a rain garden, but they go on and do amazing things as well. So this is the Master Rain Gardener class of 2013. We're in the middle of teaching it right now. And these are folks that care enough to, they're usually gardeners, which are good people just to begin with. But also, they're people excited about improving water quality. So they're stormwater geeks. And by being here, guess what you all are too. I mean, really, it's a beautiful day outside. So these are people that are really committed to not only just, you know, thinking about it, but also doing something about it in their own yards. Up on our website, I just have the pictures of all the people with their rain gardens, and you can just scroll through. It's kind of a lot of scrolling, but there are many, many pictures of beautiful rain gardens that that reflect people's perspective, their own interpretation, their own artistic interpretation of what a rain garden should look like. So here is a map of the county and then all of the green infrastructure that has been put in by the Huron River Watershed Council, the City of Ann Arbor, the Washtenaw County Water Resources Project, or Commissioner's Office. I think that's all. And you can see the orange ones are the residential rain gardens. So those are people in the community who are putting in rain gardens. And it's so, I mean, look at Ann Arbor. Good job. Good job. But also, I think it's interesting, if you look up where the Huron River is, people who live along the river are thinking about the cleanliness of the river. And you can just tell because they're starting to put in rain gardens. There's the City of Ann Arbor residential rain gardens that have been put in by citizens in partnership with us. And then, like I said, master rain gardeners go on and do amazing things. Actually, last year at the Sustainability Series, Roger Moon came and talked about rain gardens. He's a master rain gardener trained through our office. He invites people to his house, garden clubs and things like that, to see rain gardens. Also, master rain gardeners have not only educating the public about, say, the Miller Avenue rain gardens, but also putting their money where their mouth is and working to weed them. So keeping them beautiful. Because especially those really high-profile gardens, if they look great, everyone will want to do it. But if they don't look good, then that's not good PR. Actually, I just found this pretty recently, so I'm interested, is that the reason that the biggest force in how people treat their yards, whether they have grass or native plants or what kind of thing they have in their garden, is what their neighbors do, which is not so surprising, I guess. But the study, and this was in Arizona, where they're wondering why people still have lawns. The reason they found that the people who have lawns are actually more, they know that they're causing environmental degradation. It's not that they don't know. It's that their neighbors still have lawn. So by putting in a rain garden, and I know some of you out there do, you are influencing your neighbors to put in a rain garden. So good job. And why don't you go ahead. Go ahead.
Thank you. And next, I'd like to invite Shannon Gibb Randall, who's a principal with Insight Design Studio.
All righty. So Susan did a great job of talking about the small scale, what you can do at your own place, and it's so important in the city of Ann Arbor, which is pretty much built out within the city limits, not a lot of big green fields. We have to figure out what we can do with what's there and how to change it. That's why that program is so important, and it's so wonderful that Susan has done all the amazing things she's done with that program and spreading this this great news around and all this great work around. And so I'm going to take it up a level in terms of scale. So I'm going to take you through some projects on a city road and some commercial projects and some institutional examples to show you some interesting things that are happening around the city. So goals, we've been talking about this. It's basically trying to harness these ecological services that are around us. This infiltration and, you know, plants taking up water, water infiltrating down, nutrient cycling, all these things that we need and that we can kind of take advantage of that are happening, but then also looking for those places where that overlap of what we need and what the environment needs, and, you know, there's a lot of overlap there. But one of the things is also beauty. We can make these things beautiful and wonderful to live with, and they don't just have to be kind of our dull infrastructure. They can be places of restoration for us, too. So this is a project, Stone School Road. So this is right at the very edge of the city. If you're going out Stone School Road and you're heading south, you cross over I-94. And then there's a big stretch that goes all the way up to Ellsworth. So Mallets Creek comes through here. It's pretty degraded in through there. A lot of, you know, banks that are cut back and things like that, a lot of erosion. And so we're going to be redoing a lot of the banks, revegetating them, putting in, you know, some areas for big stone to try to stabilize things. But the very exciting thing is that there's big right-of-way within there in certain sections, some of which is 100 feet wide. And so in those areas, you can see where it is kind of up there. It's variable through there. It's kind of funny. So in the places where there was room, we're doing rain garden after rain garden after rain garden after rain garden. It's a whole series of them that goes all the way down the road. So it's really exciting because we're going to be taking the road runoff, and we actually have some room to do it. And it's not a ton of little houses. They're kind of bigger pieces of property, like a bigger apartment complex or a commercial place or something like that, so that we can really, we're not fighting driveways as much and things. So we have some room to spread out and be able to really do some interesting treatment. So there's a big hill that goes down, 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 down. And then there's kind of a ditch right there that connects it down to the Mallets Creek. And then it kind of goes down and through here and connects as well. So we're putting in lots of trees and doing lots of rain gardens along through there. Oh, let's see. There we go. So this is kind of a sample one of what it looks like. So because it's dropping in elevation, you have these little weirs, which are like a little mini dam. So the water flows in, and I'll have a better picture of this little structure here. Flows in off the road, goes into this rain garden. It only ponds to 6 inches deep. It's not very deep, but that's a good depth for kind of plants being able to take this stuff up. This is not a wetland. This is not something that stays permanently wet. It will dry out. So then it spills up and over and down into the next one. So you've got these curb cuts that are happening all the way up and down the street, but you also have the opportunity for this water to be kind of treated and then treated and then treated again. So you really can get some decent water quality out of this. You can see the relationship between the road and the person, just 6 inches there, not very deep. And we're planting it all up. So that's going to be beautiful to look at. It'll provide a buffer for people as they're walking down the fast-moving road. And we developed a sump structure here, which is kind of, it was interesting. So road runoff sucks. It's filled with just junk, pollution, sediment, all kinds of nastiness, trash. And that ends up in the rain garden. There's always this spot that's kind of dead if it's coming off of the road. It's really difficult to deal with, and people need to clean it out, but sometimes you put a bunch of rocks in there and it all just kind of fills up, and how do you get rid of everything? So what we did is we designed this sump structure where the water kind of comes down, flows into this thing, fills it up. It allows it to kind of still and settle down to the bottom, and then flows up and over down into the rain garden. Well, guess what? This is the same size and configuration as any other storm structure in the city. So when they take their ginormous vac truck and clean out all the other sumps, they can just stick the same thing in there and suck it out. It doesn't take any special anything to take care of this thing. So we tried to make it so it was super easy for the city to just come in and do this. Same old, just like they're doing anywhere else. So we're hoping, this is kind of our pilot project on this, we're hoping that that's going to be successful with this so that we don't have as much sediment flowing into the garden and making it difficult for those plants to establish in there.
Questions are at the end, but if you have one now, let me have the mic.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Just regarding this diagram here, will there be a curb on Stone School Road, and will there be a bike lane?
Yes. So the city has with all of their new road projects, are really trying to do bike lanes wherever they can. And I'm a big biker, so it's been wonderful to see all that happening. So there'll be, two bike lanes. There is curb all the way along here, except for this little spillway zone in through here. So it kind of bypasses, and the way that we've sloped it all, the water wants to take a turn, which is tricky to get water to want to take a turn, and goes down into this sump structure. So it'll look like a very traditional road, except it has these little places where the water takes a turn about every 300 feet-ish or so. And then we have it planted with all kinds of interesting things that hopefully spread really aggressively. We chose all species that are kind of borderline nuisance-ish at points because we knew weeding is going to be really difficult in here to get people to come and do that on a long-term basis. So we tried to get super tough things, but that's an issue that I will talk about later. So next project is a commercial project not too far from where we are here. This is 618 South Main. It's that big apartment complex that's going up on South Main across from South Main Market. Used to be Fox Tent and Awning, you can see. The big parking lot with the chain link fence around it. So this is was an acre of impervious surface there. So now this is the new building that is going up. He could have developed this whole thing as a great big building, but he didn't because he saw the wisdom of having rain gardens that serve as beautiful areas to hang out. So people can hang out on the patio here and be able to enjoy all of the gorgeous greenery around you as well. So doing double duty, stormwater and something beautiful to hang out in the middle of. We also have trees in what's called structural soil. This is big, chunky, angular aggregate that locks together and is very stable, but it's coated in a tackifier and topsoil. And so you can pour sidewalk on top of it, and it's stable, but it's also a decent place for trees to root. Average life of street tree, 7 years. So this actually gives them a chance in life, because otherwise it's a rough life. Another one that we did in conjunction with Conservation Design Forums, Patrick's in here somewhere, he worked on it too, there he is. This is City Hall, basically. So what we have here is water coming off of roofs, flowing onto green roofs, into bioretention, which is basically a fancy name for rain garden, over here and over here. So it's fun to just walk there and see what's happening, especially during a rainstorm. So green roof up here, when it's raining, it's falling down the rain chain, going through these cool stainless steel runnels, which Patrick designed, into the rain garden area here. This is it when it's not raining. You can see it right over there. And then these are also trees in structural soil.
Where is this?
This is on Huron. This is Huron, right there. Here's the loved, beloved sculpture that Ann Arbor just threw open their arms. You're welcome. And then this is the Fifth Avenue side under construction. You can see a bunch of gravel underlayment and then soil on top. You have all kinds of rain garden plants in there. Even looks pretty in the wintertime. I mean, we've seen praying mantis in here on Fifth Avenue. The Avenue. I mean, that's amazing. So you can see the water coming out there. It can spill over here. And when it's done, if it spills, goes into the trench drain, I'm getting 0 minutes. So here's the other side, porous pavement, all kinds of really cool things. And the city of Ann Arbor has done a lot of really wonderful rain gardens around the city. But boy, they don't have staff to take care of it. So we need people like you to come and help, because it's going to take all of us working together to make these things successful. And they're so good in so many ways. So boy, would it be great if people came up, out for these volunteer days that we try to set up and make these things work, because so much better than sticking them in the pipe filled with raccoon poop, folks. It really is. So.
And the last speaker we have tonight is Nathan Ayers, who's the director of the Shawara Permaculture and Partner at the U of M Permaculture Initiative.
Thank you. Okay. All right. Well, wonderful to be here with you all this evening at the beautiful library. As mentioned, my name is Nate Ayers. I'm the director of Shawara Permaculture. And it's my goal tonight to share with you an introduction into what permaculture is and perhaps some other newer concepts that are starting to emerge in sustainable systems design that we might not be as familiar with. I'm going to talk about what we do at Shawara. I'm going to talk about the partnership that we've had with the University of Michigan and how permaculture is playing a role there. And then we're going to look at solutions. And I love talking about solutions because permaculture is all about solutions and designing small-scale community-based solutions. So as you'll notice here, I'm using a different program. This is called Prezi for those of you that are interested. I love Prezi because it's all about the environment. It's all about the relationships in an environment, as opposed to, we might be familiar with PowerPoint, which is very top-down, one slide at a time. Prezi is very indicative of a relationship found in multiple environments. So permaculture, what is it? That's the million-dollar question. I love these 10-minute spots where I get to try and explain what permaculture and systems thinking is, but I'll do my best. Very much so, permaculture is an interdisciplinary design science. It combines ecology, engineering, art, and landscape architecture. The goal in permaculture is to create systems that produce more than they consume. And very much so in permaculture, we find this notion of systems thinking. And in permaculture, we translate into solutions for food, energy, water, building, transportation, and waste. What we're finding is that permaculture is very good at introducing people to biomimicry. And I've heard this mentioned before tonight about some of the city's projects. How can we mimic nature in the way that we design solutions? Well, believe it or not, folks, nature got it right. She's had millions and millions of years to get systems into place, and it's us humans who have come along and said, we know better, we can design things that'll just sort of magically allow nature to pass over us, and that's not really working out for us anymore. So biomimicry, which is a word I think we're going to hear from here on out, I think it's going to be maybe even replacing our notion of sustainability. But biomimicry means how can we design things that mimic nature, that mimic nature's patterns, functions, and designs. So permaculture is very good at quickly bringing people up to speed to start to think like nature. It's a pedagogy we can use to take people from old westernized industrialized model to new systems thinking type of formats. Great example of biomimicry applies to lots of different things, but here's one talking about some of the aerodynamics we see on these high-speed trains, totally based off of the aerodynamics found in the kingfisher bird. So a quick note here, too, about sustainable systems and systems thinking. As was mentioned, in permaculture, we think about a number of different issues: food, energy, water, building, transportation, and waste. And I realize that our focus here tonight is definitely water, and I'm going to talk about water solutions. But I would not be doing my job as a permaculturist if I didn't say that it's all very related. The way that we grow our food affects our water quality. The types of transportation systems that we use affect our water quality. So it's very important for us to get an understanding of what systems thinking really is. Whereas previously, you know, we used to think about root causes and why are they there. So in a situation like we're seeing with some of our stormwater situations in many of our neighborhoods where they're starting to back up and overflow, well, we definitely know that we're getting more rain than we used to get. That's definitely a factor. But what we would do when we're thinking about this in terms of a systems format is start to think about a lot of the other tangentials that we don't automatically come to mind. So, for example, I know in Ann Arbor, we've been cutting down a lot of ash trees because of the emerald ash borer. Well, what was the foundation of that? You know, are the winters warmer and the borers aren't being called off like they used to be? Those ash trees play a significant role in stormwater retention. So when we cut all those trees down, we're going to start to see more water back up. And this is just an example to illustrate. Let's get all the ingredients. Let's collect the dots and then connect the dots rather than just think cause and effect. Because everything that we're doing on planet Earth is interrelated. And as permaculture designers, again, we have a lot of different aspects, principles, and ethics that go into the way that we design solutions. So permaculture very much so started as an agricultural design science. How can we create permanent agriculture? But what we're seeing now is this lens that permaculturists utilize can do much more than just create agricultural solutions. We can create solutions in a number of different aspects of human endeavors. So I love that closed-loop systems was mentioned earlier, because that's really where the rubber meets the road, is how can we design systems where the output of one system becomes the input of another? There's no waste. Things are recycled. And really, one of the best examples that we have of closed-loop systems is the forest. And all of our classes in permaculture start outside. Let's get outside. Let's see how nature does it. And a forest is one of the best classrooms that I could take students into, because a forest demonstrates one of these closed-loop systems. And we're all very familiar with this. We know that in the spring and summer, those trees take up nutrients from the ground, up through their trunks, put it out into their leaves, and then what happens in the fall? Those leaves fall down, become organic material, things for that tree to be able to do the same exact thing the next year. It's a closed-loop system. And this is a beautiful design from nature that we can mimic, not just in how we design, you know, food solutions and energy solutions and water solutions, but actually how we design organizations and businesses and interactions amongst one another. So nature has quite a bit to teach us. So how did Chiwara Permaculture get started? Well, believe it or not, I started out of my house. In 2010, I started the company with a very simple goal, which is how do we get the standard American house off of fossil fuels? In food, energy, water, building, transportation, and waste. How do we get off fossil fuels? I started asking these questions. I didn't really know how, but I was going to take a crack at it. So we started having classes. We grew a lot of food. We put in some water solutions. I started inviting over neighborhood schools to start to ask some of these questions with me, using it as a hands-on demonstration site. This is all places that we're familiar with in Ann Arbor, but how can we get our minds really wrapped around some of these newer solutions? We started doing a lot of things with different food production, perennial polyculture systems, rainwater retention. This is like a quintessential permaculture installation right here. This is a permaculture food forest. The picture on the top is us doing the earthworks. It's a simple system of swales and berms. And then 2 years later, we have about 17 different types of food, edible, medicinal crops growing in that same space. It catches a ton of water rather than running off down the back of my property into my neighbor's basement. So it's a very functional solution. Catches water, produces food, creates habitat. We call this stacking functions in permaculture. Here's another example from my backyard. This is where we grow all of our kale. We're crazy green smoothie people in the summertime. But this is a great example of biomimicry. These are our raised beds in our backyard, and the design was based off of a leaf structure. And very simple, just like a leaf does, it channels water where it wants to go down the stem, creates overflow valves, and that's what we were mimicking in the way that we grow food in our backyard. Oh, for all the nature geeks up there at the top, there's a Fibonacci spiral. Okay, so University of Michigan, how did they get involved? Well, they came calling and we wanted to figure out how does permaculture fit into the University of Michigan. We did a couple of research examples. We found that very much so, permaculture is interdisciplinary. If it had to go anywhere, it would probably be in engineering. But we started doing a lot of research projects with U of M. That gave birth to the University of Michigan Permaculture Design Team, which is still flourishing, and I'll touch on here in a second. We did a really cool research project this past year looking at how the University of Michigan could offset their carbon footprint with sequoia trees. The university bought into our research and let us plant 12 giant sequoias in the arboretum, which are there. You can go check out. And the permaculture design team, as mentioned, received $10,000 to install a 3-acre food forest at Matai Botanical Gardens, which is going in this spring. So a lot of activity happening at the university revolving around permaculture. I love that ecosystem services was mentioned earlier. Nate, that's not an accurate time reading. It went from 5 to 2 in about 30 seconds. We just released a report, Permaculture and the Value of Nature in Washtenaw County. I'm happy to email that to anybody. But talking about how can we start to account for the value that nature provides for us. A lot of this stuff, these green transitions, it's going to come down to bookkeeping. It's going to come down to who's keeping the books. So we want to look accurately at the value that nature provides for us. So residential and municipal water solutions. Tree canopy, this is one of the biggest ones. As I mentioned, trees catch and store a massive amount of water before intersects it before it gets to the stormwater system. So it behooves us to have good tree coverage, good tree canopy in Ann Arbor. Lawns to gardens, this one is very self-explanatory. We are no longer the aristocracy in Europe. We do not need lawns. We can grow our own food. This helps out tremendously in terms of catching and storing rainwater. Lots of examples in that in Ann Arbor. I love the curb cuts. I love what's happening. These are awesome examples of ways to catch and store water before it gets into the city's stormwater system. This is a great example that we did in Highland Park. I taught the first permaculture design course in Highland Park in 2010, and we designed something called a crater garden. This is on one city lot, 40 by 90 feet long. In Highland Park, the water rates went up by 29% in 2011, so we needed a solution to grow food and use less water. We designed a system that caught and stored every single drop of water and grew a lot of food. What did it look like 4 months later? There's the same garden right there. We had people come from all over the world to see what we were doing there. This is a simple solution, catching and storing water, growing lots of food. There's a little before and after. I love gray water systems. The city needs to get serious about this, about putting it into the coding. Gray water systems work. Agricultural water solutions. This is a very important graphic right here. Anybody remember what happened in Toledo at the end of the summer? Do not drink the water. The reason why? Agricultural runoff. The way that we grow food drastically affects our drinking water. We can change this by transitioning to perennial-based systems, getting away from annual monocultures. that expose the topsoil, leaving it to run off down to our rivers, lakes, and streams, and switching over to perennial polycultures. Lots of different food growing, lots of different systems in place there. This is what this looks like scaled up, 50, 100,000 acres. I think it's very beautiful, on contour with the landscape, producing lots of different food. And finishing up here, industrial toxin water solutions. If this isn't familiar to you, it should be familiar to you. This is the dioxane plume that's making its way towards Ann Arbor. Permaculture has solutions to offer. We definitely want to look at a gentleman who went to the University of Michigan named John Todd, designing bioremediation systems that work very well, cleaning up toxins, cleaning up all kinds of pollutants, and actually being able to remove different types of sewer systems and cleaning all kinds of black water with plants, with species and things like that. So what we find in permaculture is that the most resilient solutions stem from engaged citizens that have taken responsibility for their community systems. Permaculture is very good at that, about empowering people to take responsibility for themselves in food, energy, water, building, transportation, and waste. Thank you very much.
Oh, come on.
Anybody
must
can
have
raise
a, someone
their hand?
Must have a question.
Comment? Question?
I have an interesting tidbit that I can throw out there. How many catch basins do you think the city of Ann Arbor has? Evan, you can't get this question.
32.
A little bit higher.
At a zero, maybe?
15,000.
Really?
15,000 catch basins that clog with leaves, that clog with cigarette butts, that have ice frozen over them. So keep that in mind when you start thinking about where that storm drain goes. We have 15,000 inlets to the Huron River.
Yeah, I have a question for Sue, I guess. Early on, Laura showed us all these graphic of Michigan Stadium, how much water is falling on Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. And we're building rain gardens. It's infiltrating a little bit of water here, a little bit of water there. How many rain gardens do we need to build to take care of those stadiums?
How many rain gardens?
And really, the question is, how many? Just a few here and there are nice, and they're going to spread the word, and they get other people interested, and it's going to grow, I'm sure, and especially here in Ann Arbor. But how many do we need to build to really make a difference?
That's a good question, actually, because it seems like when you build a rain garden, it seems like what you're capturing isn't a lot. But once people get into it, I know that some people have made it so that no water runs off their property. And it's not that difficult, actually. I mean, even just putting it in an existing bed, that one of the master rain gardeners actually, he built a rain garden, and then he built another one, and then he built one for his neighbor. And then he realized, actually, I have four because my patio already runs off into my, you know, my herb garden. So you get a little of credit for those sorts of things. And any gardener, anyone who gardens, when you're improving the soil and putting compost in the soil and improving the infiltration of the soil, you're already doing a lot. Like all that, all of those vegetable gardens where the water falls and just soaks in instead of running off, that does a lot of good. And I'll think about numbers because actually we were just figuring out how many. All of the rain gardens that partners of ours have put in, we're up to. And Evan can correct me if I say this wrong, but I think we're up to 2 million gallons per year. What was your figure, Laura? It was a lot. So, yeah, it's probably just a chunk of that. And I don't know if you had it in gallons.
Uh, 117 million gallons.
Okay, so we've gotten two. So far. Every little bit helps.
But actually, yeah. Wait a second.
Okay.
That's the volume of one Michigan stadium.
Oh.
And we were saying that it's 117 of those. So if somebody could do the math for me, it's 117 times 160 million gallons. So
that's
a lot.
Quite a bit.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot. That said, though, when you go outside and you see the water coming out of your downspout and going down your driveway and into the gutter, it's quite a bit. So even though you're doing a tiny little amount in the grand scheme of things, and that's the
all of the rain that falls on the city. When we capture water in a rain garden, we're capturing the number of rain events. So if you think about doing your dishes, it's not that the amount of water that comes off one dish, it's the number of dishes that you clean. So every time it rains, the water washes all of that dirt into the river. So the number of events that you can capture, and with a rain garden, you're getting about 85% of those. So that sounds better than 2 out of 117 times. A very large number.
And I guess I would say, in terms of looking more sort of holistically, I think the story that we're trying to convey tonight is, too, historically we focused a lot on our gray infrastructure, our pipes, our roads, our conveyance channels that Jen talked a lot about. And we're seeing with the increased precipitation, that is not, we are not going to build our way out of this. And so what I think we've been trying to get a sense of is whether it's through increasing the tree canopy, whether it's through increasing in biomimicry, whether it's the rain gardens, whether it's infiltration, we need to start incorporating more of the green infrastructure into the solutions. It's not that one thing like planting the whole city in rain gardens is going to solve our problem. It's going to be a mixture of the gray and the green together. Janine?
It was great, exciting to hear all of you speak. Thank you so much for sharing all of that and for doing what you did. I have one little question and then a bigger question. The little question is, how is the stormwater runoff fee charged by the city? How do they figure out what that's supposed to be for somebody? Jen, I guess.
Sure, that's actually a question for the city. So the city of Ann Arbor has a stormwater utility. We're one of 9 communities in the state of Michigan that has a stormwater utility. We collect that fee based on the impervious area per parcel. So we have a plane, we don't have the plane, we hire a plane every 3 years to fly over the city and take color infrared photography and calculate the impervious area per parcel. Mm. So we have an idea of exactly how much runoff comes off of each parcel, and that's where the fee comes from.
Is that published?
That's published, that's made available. You can actually go online on the city website, pull up your own parcel, and you can see the map that we use. And if you have a question about it, feel free to challenge it. We had one gentleman who was really concerned because his daughter's sandbox, which didn't have a bottom, was showing up as impervious area. And so he was able to say, hey, wait a minute, you're charging me for that. And we said, you know what? You're right. We'll change it. So, yeah, that information is certainly available.
And the other question is, what do we do when we see silt running off of, you know, construction areas or whatever, going down?
Call me.
Call you.
Okay. The city has a soil erosion and sedimentation control program specifically mm-hmm. for construction sites.
Okay.
And we inspect the sites periodically. Construction sites, large-scale commercial sites, we inspect more often. Residential sites, we don't inspect as often. But if you have a complaint or you see something, the email is stormwater@a2gov.org.
Okay.
That's a really simple one. Or call the building department. You can lodge the complaint or email me. We'll send our inspector out there. And, you know, our developers, they know. They know what they're supposed to be doing. And certainly watchful eyes from the community help us with our job.
Yeah, across from Georgetown, that huge development.
Oh, yeah.
Pouring
out
of there,
tomorrow morning.
Down Packard, hitting all the storm drains, nothing's in them.
It's on my inspection list for tomorrow morning.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And then the other is there's a dirt road, a street, Kimberly, that comes into Packard. I was biking here, huge amounts of silt coming out off that street and onto Packard. What can happen with those kinds of things?
The dirt road?
The dirt road.
That's a little bit of a different instance, and so we can't necessarily write ourselves a ticket.
I know, but...
But that is something that we can work with our roads department to talk about crown of the road and appropriate grading for the road. In the springtime, we go out with all of our dirt roads and regrade them, and so we can make sure that that's listed appropriately.
Yeah, well, so it slopes right down to Packard, so some kind of a catch basin or something there for it. But anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
I love how Janine is bringing this sort of thing up. And if everyone here and everyone who watches this later, if they are annoyed when they see someone's gravel driveway or their downspout washing sediment into the street, if it feels like, you know, his fingernails on the chalkboard, that's good.
My name's Barb.
I've been a part of a Ann Arbor institution for 30 years now, and that would be Pittsfield Village, which was originally an apartment complex and then a cooperative and now a condo. And lots of beautiful green grassy areas there, built in the 1940s. Charles Noble built this wonderful complex that is well-sustained. Two questions that I have. One is that we have kind of been told that advised not to plant food at our place directly in the ground because the buildings had been painted with lead paint at some point in the past, and that's still there. So first of all, how far away from a lead paint building can you actually be growing food? And the second part is, I know, just looking at those wonderful green grassy areas, but I've also thought, gee, we could grow so much stuff here. And it would be nice if that is something that it would have to be evolve over many years and many people. But if you have suggestions on how to...
Sure, I can take a stab at that. The first thing I would suggest doing is getting a soil test where you want to grow food. MSU Extension has mail-in kits that you can do, but that's something that you would want to have the building owner, the property managers, look into. Yeah. The secondary piece to that is that there are all kinds of plants that will do bioremediation, that will take up different kinds of toxins and things like that. So that's something that probably needs to be addressed by the building maintenance owners, folks like that. Yeah. If you want to grow food, though, there are a lot of different types of ways that you can get around that. Potentially by installing some raised beds boxes and bringing in some soil from somewhere else. Right. There's all kinds of like hydroponics and aquaponic systems that don't even use soil anymore that you can put in a window. Something called windowgardens.org is really great. but then also getting into more perennials. Particularly native trees, fruit trees, nut trees, service berries, things like that, things that don't require as much maintenance as a regular garden. Those are some avenues, but I strongly believe in people's right to grow food where they live, so hopefully your building folks will be agreeable with that.
And the landscape people.
Yeah, for Mr. Ayers, I wonder if you can go into why permaculturists don't till and plant on raised beds, and maybe how people that live in the city of Ann Arbor could take part in a larger scale food growing permaculture in surrounding areas.
Sure. So the gentleman mentioned this concept of no-till farming, which is big in permaculture. We're starting to realize the supreme importance of the soil food web. And this is the universe that exists underneath our feet, all the microbes, arthropods, critters, and things like that that supply the nutrients to the food that we eat. And what we found in over 100 years of industrial agriculture in this country is we've exposed the topsoil through plowing every year, all the nutrients get washed away. All the industrial types of chemicals and things like that that are used on commercial farms wash down, like we saw in that algae bloom in Lake Huron this summer. So the no-till approach is, for a couple different reasons, is A, we're losing topsoil rapidly in this country. The USDA estimates we're losing about 2 billion tons of topsoil every year, and that's just unfathomable. It's like, how much longer until we run out? So these permaculture methods are designed to build topsoil year after year. So that's a big one. But also engaging the soil food web. This concept of nutrient-dense food is very, very important. The food that we're eating now does not have the nutrients that our grandparents used to get in the food. So how can we leave the soil in place but enhance it? So permaculture could also be synonymous with regenerative agriculture, systems that build topsoil and replenish and restore the soil underneath there. In terms of endeavors to get involved in around the community to grow more food, Ann Arbor has a fantastic CSA scene, lots of different farms that are community-supported agriculture. You pay the farmer up front for his work, and you get a share every week of that food. There's lots of different community garden plots people can get involved with in Ann Arbor, Project Grow and things like that, which has wonderful classes all year long. But the thing I'll maybe end with is start your own permaculture education. Permaculture is all about empowering people where they are, using what they've got, doing what they can.
You know, so it's people who are sort of not in the boat of complaining a lot and waiting for other people to solve things, people that want to fix things themselves. Permaculture is a beautiful vehicle for doing that with. Thanks.
Thanks for tonight, and I applaud all four of you to be a part of the great community in Ann Arbor that has led to one of the top 10 communities that really addresses and understands what rainwater management is all about. And you actually stole my song about soils.
Soil geek.
So, yeah, and same here. We're heavily into sustainable agriculture ourselves with as a landscape architect as well. And I think it, as he has brought out, is the microorganisms, the beneficial microorganisms, are a very important component of the system itself. Yes, they are. The soils are a very important conduit to infiltration, but it's those little bugs that are in there that are actually making it much more efficient for the nutrients to get into the plant material. So when we start to look at rain gardens, we start to look at agriculture, the microorganisms are extremely important and should have equal attention to the design of the plant material itself, because in order for that plant to survive and flourish, it's not just the water that's feeding to the system or the high organic content, but it's those little bugs that are in there. And when you can start to think about in a temperate forest in a square yard, the number of species and organisms in that area in a very healthy, fertile soil is equal to that of a rainforest above ground. So it's really important to understand our soils, and being the year of the soils by the United Nations, let's be more serious about it.
And thank you.
There's I was just at the Wildflower Association of Michigan conference and listened to a soils lecture where actually at Cornell they'll do a soil test, but it's not just just the nutrients in the soil, and it's not just the soil texture. They'll also do, and not, so it's not just chemistry, but it's also the soil structure and also the soil, the bio community that's there. So anyone can send in a soil sample. You don't have to live in New York. So that I thought that was a resource that we could all perhaps use.
And real quick,
hang on just a moment because we want to hear you, honestly.
Yeah, and real quick, the same individual researcher that did that is saying that no-till actually delivers, when a farmer puts in phosphorus or any type of fertilizer, the no-till system actually accelerates the absorption and conveyance to the stream systems. So there's some counterproduction, not to say that no-till is good, but it's interesting to see those kind of studies that are starting to come out.
All right, we have another question back here.
Hi, I work in the Ann Arbor Public Schools, and I wondered, I know you spoke about doing presentations about the rain gardens and the hydrology cycle. I wondered if there were any other outreach programs for our schools, because I just feel like that is the most important way to transmit this stewardship component and to reach the families within Ann Arbor?
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about what the city is certainly working on. We have a partnership right now with the Ecology Center, and I think we actually have a new contract coming out, but we look for in-school education, and we, how many is it? Several hundred presentations that we invite schools to ask for, and so the Ecology Center goes out to the schools. They bring, again, second through sixth grade curriculum, so depending on what it is. And it's recycling, it's water conservation, it's ecology, it's rain gardens, it's Stormwater 101. So there's a lot of different modules that the teacher can sign up for. If you're interested in something like that, certainly contact the city. But I know that the Ecology Center does some really great programs on their own. The Leslie Science and Nature Center does some really great programs also. And I know that some of them have the curriculum in a box that the teachers can check out and bring to their classrooms. So that certainly would be some cool opportunities that I know of, at least from the city aspect.
If you're interested in building a rain garden specifically, then actually one of our she's actually a former Peace Corps member. She did this in South America. But she'll come out and talk to you about rain gardens and help you find a site for one. And then she also has curriculum ties that she can share.
And I guess I was thinking, I know there are a lot of programs within the elementary and middle schools, but some of our other schools are introducing more technology, and there's an AP environmental science curriculum now where there might be some overlap.
I can speak to this just real quick. I'm very thankful that you brought up education, because I see in all this transition towards sustainable infrastructure and education and things like that, working with K through 12 schools might be one of these leverage points where we can really get some serious traction here. We're very lucky to be in Ann Arbor, a city that takes education so seriously, and there is a revolution happening in education right now with this transition to all these buzzwords: project-based learning, problem-based learning, STEM education, STEAM education. What are we talking about here? We're talking about getting students out of the traditional classroom and into a contextualized learning environment, i.e. their community, solving problems, solving food issues, water issues, energy issues. I'm a big believer of permaculture in K through 12 schools. I wrote an article called Why Permaculture Should Be Taught in Every School in America. I think it's a beautiful vehicle for STEM education, getting kids to think about closed-loop systems and engineering. We need more engineers in this country. So I've worked with Ann Arbor Public Schools. We do the Green Adventures Camp every year. We've designed curriculum for Detroit Public Schools, Summers Knoll. Would be happy to continue the dialogue more with you. But really, I think the key difference here is it's not about designing curriculum that meets, you know, the alignment tables of National Science Standards and Common Core. It's about empowering teachers to take their students out, and the teachers become empowered to teach this stuff because they're passionate about it. And it's not so much about measuring this stuff on, you know, institutionalized, standardized tests. It's about engagement. That's what we should be measuring, is how the students are engaged with solving problems in their community. So I think permaculture is a really powerful vehicle for doing that with.
And one last point on that. Like the city has a lot of regulations to manage stormwater, schools, large school districts do too, and the Ann Arbor Public School District has a permit to manage their stormwater. They're required to do stormwater improvements on their sites. They're required to do public education. And so a lot of times that comes organically from within the school. I know that the county is working especially with Thurston schools and doing a lot of educational programming around Thurston Pond and catching the stormwater off of the roofs. And we work with many schools on those kinds of things, too, at the high school level, too.
Could I just add one thing also? And that is, if you're going to take on some sort of project at your school, because we've done some as well, think about the long term in terms of who's taking care of it, because you can always get a bunch of people to show up for the implementation. It's much harder 5 years out to continue the management of it, because those kids are turning over constantly. So every fall and spring, I go to my kids' school where we put in 2 rain gardens, and I talk about it every season to be able to introduce the new ones and then to remind them in the spring that they can't go running all over it while the baby plants are coming up. It almost got killed by fairy houses being built out of all of the little twiggy things out there, which is wonderful, but you don't want to kill it, you know. So there's some special needs with schools in terms of how you deal with those, because you want them in it and engaging with it, but they can also kill it pretty easily too. So you just want to make sure that there's kind of a balancing act, and it takes somebody there truly looking after it for the long term. And so it may be you, you know. So that's the thing you have to be comfortable with, is that you're willing to be the shepherd that's going to take it into the future.
My question is about gray water recycling, and I guess there was a mention of gray water recycling coating, and I'm just kind of curious if there's things going on in Ann Arbor to push that forward, or kind of what the status on that is.
I'll take that from the city perspective. Yes, there is. You need to coordinate with our building department. There are a lot of state building codes that do have to be adhered to, but the building department is willing. I think we have one right now that we're sitting down and working through building code with. It's not as easy as just flipping a switch, though. It's some of those regulations that we have to follow. But if systems can be designed to still adhere to state building code, then the building department, the plumbing department, really, is willing to work with property owners.
I think it's going to take people asking over and over and over again. The institutions will not change unless there are lots of people coming and asking. And we've been associated with a couple of projects where we've been asking and asking, and it hasn't gone very far, but the asking is really important too, because that's the only way you move the needle. And so even if you don't get everything you want, still knock on the door, because that's really important. Michigan is really far behind with this stuff. It is happening all over the country, and it is not happening here. And I really believe that it's just important that you keep pushing it, because it is utterly logical to do this. It really is.
I do want to add that the city and the county actually are going to have a little joint meeting probably in early April between public health at the county and code enforcement. The issue is, as they say, that the state building code, there's really no flexibility there, but there are some gaps in the state building code about rainwater use, and I am hopeful that this little work group can identify what's inbounds, what's not covered, what are they doing in drought-stressed states. California, Georgia, Oregon all have dealt with this. It's not terribly difficult, but there is a mindset issue, and I would echo what Shannon said, just repeatedly asking, because that's how it's bubbled over to the county offices, and I know some of the county commissioners are aware and hopefully will publicly be expressing support in the near future of, can't we figure out at least the parts where we have some leeway? Because there are realistic public health issues, but, you know, my dog's probably not going to die if it drinks out of the toilet, and I'm going to try to keep my kids from doing that. So we don't have to go overboard where other states have figured out how to do this safely.
What have they done?
What's
like
that?
Some examples, I guess. You know, you're talking very generically.
Yeah, sure. So the state plumbing code actually does say how you can reuse water from your sink, but you basically have to double pipe your house and have check valves, and that costs money, and that's what you have to do. There's no variability there. The as I understand it, the state plumbing code is totally silent on taking rainwater and using that to flush your toilet. That's probably an area where there could be, if the public health department at the county is willing to put a standard out there like the public health department at the county did for on-site sewage treatment systems, there is an opportunity where public health can take a leadership role. But there does need to be a perceived need, because those people are busy. There's nobody sitting around twiddling their thumbs at the health department. So they need to hear that is a desire, a need, a demand of the constituency. So that's one specific example. I do not know if there are other areas. I hope there are some discovered. But we hope to take a thorough look at what is desired, what are the obstacles, which obstacles can we overcome.
Evan, could you please introduce yourself for those in the room that don't know you?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm Evan Pratt. I'm the County Water Resources Commissioner, and I have no statutory authority over gray water, but it sure sounds like something that we could work on. And so I'm trying to encourage people to get in a room and see if they're interested in working on it.
Thanks.
And I think we're just about out of time right now.
Okay. I want to just thank you all for coming tonight. I know that many of us will be here if you have a follow-up question, but thank you.